So welcome everyone to our discussion about distribution, wherever books are sold. I will introduce our panelists and then do sort of a bit of a level setting of what we mean when we say distribution, and then we'll jump into the questions and we'll have time for a Q&A towards the end. So Andrew DeYoung is publisher for books at 1517 Media, overseeing the three imprints of Broadleaf Books, Beaming Books, and Fortress Press. He's also the author of The Exo Project, a 2018 Minnesota Book Award winner, The Temps, and The Day He Never Came Home, a Minnesota-set thriller forthcoming in July from Sourcebooks. Hannah Kelberg is the vice president of Wise Inc. Media. With more than a decade of experience in publishing, she has helped almost 200 authors bring their sizable stories to life. She has presented about publishing at the Loft Literary Center, the Wordsmith Conference, IBPA's Publishing University, which plug for that is going to be here in Minneapolis in 2025, technically in St. Paul, excuse me, but in Minnesota next year, and right on Door Country County. Hannah is the co-founder of Air Artist Collective, which curates monthly variety shows and zines for more than 6 years, and her installation art has been a part of the Art Shanty projects, and her writing has been featured in Publishers Weekly and Paper Darts. And Dr. Tyner, who will be joining us any moment, is a passionate educator, award-winning author, civil rights attorney, sought-after speaker, and advocate for justice. She lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is the founder of the Planting People, Growing Justice Leadership Institute. So when we think about book distribution, it can mean many different things. It's basically the process of getting books from the publishers or the authors into the hands of readers. And that can be literal or metaphorical when we talk about digital distribution. It can involve various activities, including warehousing, logistics, marketing, and sales, to ensure that the books are available in retail stores, online platforms, libraries, or any other kind of distribution method that you can think of, basically wherever consumers can access or purchase them. Distribution can look like running a warehouse and managing a sales team, handling print-on-demand through Ingram Spark or a similar service, getting full service support from a specialized distributor like Consortium Book Sales and Distribution, which is part of Ingram, or being cataloged by a big five publisher like Penguin Random House. It can look like many different things in between. So I'm hoping that our panelists can give us a variety of their experiences so that we can showcase sort of the wide variety of actual distribution experiences that there are. So first, I'd like to ask each panelist to just give us a brief overview of how your press is currently handling distribution and what that process has looked like over the last couple years, maybe, and focusing specifically on print at this time. So Andrew, we could start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Rachel. So 1517 Media, which includes a book business and then another publishing business as well, which I may talk about soon. We have our own warehouse. It is not a building that we own per se. We contract with a third party warehousing company, but they're not a distributor. They receive, pick, pack, and ship our orders. We take orders directly and fulfill directly to the major book wholesalers, Ingram, Baker & Taylor, as well as bookselling accounts like obviously Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and some others. We have a series of rep groups, commission sales rep groups that represent our list to all of North America at this point. We've got representation in Canada and then the United States, and they mostly pitch indies. And then we also have a sales force in, or a sales group, bringing our books into the UK. So that's the print side of it, and there's a patchwork of partners that bring our books to the trade, to the educational market, and to libraries, and all those places. Digitally, we have a partner who takes our ebooks and makes sure that they go everywhere that ebooks go, and then audio, which of course is a growing piece of the publishing picture. We sort of did that ourselves for a while on a very small selection of our book list, but we're only really in with Audible, which is, of course, owned by Amazon. Since then, we've pursued audiobook distribution mostly through a partner called Recorded Books that publishes many thousands of audiobooks every year. And we essentially license audio rights to them, and then they get those, they produce things and get those audiobooks wherever audiobooks can go, which includes Audible, but also Overdrive and Libro FM and a lot of different places. So that is kind of the 30,000-foot view of our distribution model.
Thank you. So I'll repeat the question for Dr. Tyner. Welcome. We're asking, can you give us a brief description of how your press is handling print distribution now and how maybe that's changed over the last several years? So Hannah, we'll go to you next.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Rachel. So like Rachel said, I work for Wise Inc. Media, and we are a hybrid book publisher. And for those of you who are less familiar with the model, it takes the quality standards and professional guidance and curated list of royalty or traditional publishing, but we have the business model of self-publishing. And so authors pay to publish their work. And then depending on the hybrid publisher, get the majority of the royalties. At Wise Inc., our authors get 100% of royalties for every book sold. And so that really influences how we've set up our distribution options. Because our authors own their rights and, you know, are really in control of their sales, they have a lot of agency in what distribution path is going to work the best for us or for them. And so one of my primary jobs when talking with authors about distribution is consulting with them and really educating them to empower them on what distribution strategy is the best fit for their marketing plan. So for some authors, that looks like going straight to POD. So that could be setting it up on KDP with Ingram Spark and then managing distribution that way. Other authors will print their books and have them shipped directly to their home or to their office if they have a wide network and they're really able to reach their audience without a middleman. So a lot of times this is like a speaker, anybody who has like an online shop selling other things. They sometimes will just completely manage distribution on their own. But for most of the authors we work with, we set them up with our distribution partner, Itasca Books. Itasca Books is based in Minneapolis. They are under the umbrella of Bookmobile, which a lot of local publishers work with. And within Itasca Books, there's also a couple different options that we consult with our authors on what to choose between. The first one is storage only and drop shipping. So again, somebody who has already an existing network and really just doesn't want to be the one going to the post office themselves to fulfill it. So they'll store the books in a climate-controlled warehouse, and then they can place that drop ship order to get the books to where they need to go. The second option is Amazon Seller only. And so what's interesting about Amazon Seller is that it's basically a limited version of Amazon Advantage, which you would get through full distribution. So you don't have access to Amazon Prime with Amazon Seller. You also don't have access to pre-orders, but you make more profit per book sold. Usually, for most of our authors, taking into account some of Itasca's fees, they're doubling what they make per book sale going through Amazon Advantage going through Amazon Seller compared to Amazon Advantage. And then the third option that Itasca sets authors up with or has the ability to set authors up with is that full trade distribution that really replicates what most major publishers have. So it gets them into Amazon Advantage, into Ingram, and the other major distribution networks. Thank you.
Great. And Dr. Tyner?
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here with you all. I am a traditional publisher, but I'm probably the most untraditional publisher you ever met, as I do all the things that you heard thus far. But in addition to that, I would say I kind of took the Jay-Z model. I sell books out the trunk. I sell at book festivals, pop-ups, and everything in between. I would say the biggest thing that I was trying to accomplish was understanding my audience and who my customer base was. Now, of course, I will tell you for libraries, the most supportive piece has been working with BiblioLabs. It helped us because we received 2 awards through the Minnesota Author Project, so that gave us a platform to engage with the libraries quite effectively. Of course, we're using all the other platforms with Ingram and Amazon and everything else in between. All those things worked until we found our distribution partner, which is Learner Publishing. Then we could take it to scale in meaningful ways. But for me, I would say the issue and why we were founded might give you a sense of why I said I'm probably the most untraditional person here on the panel or that you'll ever meet. I'm a civil rights attorney by training. I noticed that far too many of my clients learn how to read while in prison. And I thought to myself, yes, I can represent as many clients as I can, or I could try to provide inspiration through our books in meaningful ways. So I got scrappy. And then I met this man that you all probably heard of, Jack Canfield. And Jack Canfield, and you can tell I'm a talker, but I couldn't talk to him. I was like, you were like you're the goat. Like, no one can walk up and talk to you. And my friend kind of pushed me into his chest, and the rest is history. And one of the things that we talked about was this very piece. Because if you think about someone who's, what, sold a billion books at this point, just out of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, what was his distribution plan? He has everything that we're all going to talk about, but he also had that unconventional piece that truly he found his audience in a very nuanced way. And can you believe what his major channel of distribution is still today? Non-denominational churches. Because they're used as Sunday school books. I was like, come again? As a Sunday school teacher, I didn't see that one coming. But I give you that just as an example. Yes, we have all the traditional models that you'll hear about, but I also want to give everyone an invitation to play into your strengths. All of a sudden, I was teaching Sunday school a little different. I was like, our books can supplement Sunday school. So we have everything that you've heard so far. Amazon, we have the traditional distribution through Learner, but we also have those unconventional pieces that we cultivate every day.
The next question is, when you think about all of these different partners that you have to work with, what does the communication process look like with them from metadata to sales? Hannah, we'll start with you this time.
Thanks. So I want to be funnier now. Everyone was laughing for you. You raised the bar. when we partner with Itasca Books, we compile all the metadata for them and we submit it through their system to set up. And so we use tools like Publisher Rocket. If anybody's not using that, I highly recommend Publisher Rocket. When we purchased it, it cost $100 for the life of the book, and it gives you a lot of search engine optimization resources for compiling your metadata. So it'll tell you, you know, here's how many people are searching for this keyword in a month. And it'll tell you, like, here's how many books you have to sell to get to number 10 in this category and to get to number 1 in this category. So we put a lot of time and energy into that compilation of the metadata, specifically making it optimized for Amazon, since even though we encourage people to buy through other channels, Amazon is the biggest search engine for books. Oftentimes I'll search for a book on Amazon and then buy it off Libro FM, you know, for audiobooks. And so we really carefully curate that metadata and we submit it to Itasca Books for them to send it to all the appropriate channels. But after the book is set up, we also do help with some of the troubleshooting. And so, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people have experienced how Amazon can be glitchy and how something can be good one day, the listing's looking great, and then on launch day, maybe we've had listings fully disappear. And so we are actively checking. We're not just passing it off to our distribution partner. We are at Wise Inc. actively checking the listings multiple times before the launch, at the launch, and kind of, you know, sometimes we're even sending Amazon help tickets ourselves. But we're also doing the communication with the author. And so while the author can communicate with our distribution partner directly, they're also, you know, communicating with us as really their trusted partner throughout the time. So the team effort, I'd say, with our distribution system.
Dr. Tyner?
I concur. I would say overall, the metadata piece, we work in partnership with Learner. We have ongoing communication to outline our processes and our next steps and finding our audience and how to engage them most effectively. But I should tell you another piece of my story. When I said I'm the untraditional person here, I try to get as many resources in kind and support so we get more revenue. We're a social enterprise, so we can get more books in the hands of children. Thus far, we've donated 26,000 diverse books. I want to double that annually. So with that being said, I had someone pick up a delivery yesterday. They said, well, they brought it to the truck in a wheelchair. I was like, yes, because our warehouse is in a disability services warehouse where we partner for some of the distribution. They were like, what? I was like, don't worry about it. So the answer to the metadata piece is, we have a lot of student interns that support us. Like last night, I was working with the University of Maryland. So they're analyzing the data constantly. So it helps us that way when we're preparing for the next catalog and for the next set of books that we're going to publish, we are getting the data and analyzing on a consistent basis with the support, in-kind support, of Professor Sanders and his students.
And Andrew?
Yeah, so I mean, echoing everything that's been said, metadata is extremely important. after we compile metadata for a particular list, we send it everywhere it needs to go. And we have a system where we compile our metadata internally. And then we have what's called an Onyx feed that essentially kind of like takes it and wraps it up in a way that all the different accounts can actually receive, because different accounts have different portals and different requirements. And if you don't have a system that can kind of give every place what they need, you're going to have someone just copy pasting the same information into a lot of different systems, and that's extremely time-consuming, and presumably, like Itasca, this is something that they have after you pass it off to them. I'd say we also, you know, we have an internal sales team. We've got a national sales director named Annette Hughes, and then a sales associate who's here, Jenna Solomon. I might be directing people to her for questions afterwards, because like she's an expert on so much of this and very in the weeds with like the metadata and pitching accounts. But we also have personal relationships with folks at Ingram, at Baker & Taylor, certainly with the commission sales rep groups. And one of the important things that we do every season is we have a sales conference where we go through every title that we plan on publishing in the next season, and we sort of just present it to all the sales groups, including folks who sell overseas, and kind of just try to get them excited about these things, equip them with the tools that they need to bring these books out and actually sell them into the channels. And we also talk about the things that we're going to do to support those books. And that's the place where I think distribution bleeds into sales, marketing, publicity, because distribution as such merely guarantees that you can be bought in a particular channel. It does not guarantee that you will be present in that channel. You know, you have an author who walks into Barnes & Noble, says, why isn't my book on the shelf? Well, we have distribution there. They didn't pick that one up. So that is where sort of the sales conference comes in, because these salespeople want to go to Barnes & Noble, to any indie, and say, you should really put this book on your shelves. And not only should you put it on your shelves, but here's how the publisher is going to support it, so that you have some reasonable expectation that not only are you going to put it on your shelf, but it's going to sell. Maybe that's enough on that question. We could go deep on that one, but that's maybe another panel.
I did not plan it, but metadata is a passion of mine. That's how all books are discovered now. And I'm just so pleased to hear everybody talk about metadata as a living thing.
Nerd.
You have to keep it updated. You have to check in on it. The other thing I didn't know as I put this panel together was how much of a hodgepodge of solutions all of you have had to cobble together. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the benefits and the challenges of the hodgepodge of partners and resources that you have with your particular setups. And Dr. Tyner, we could start with you.
Okay, I knew that was coming, right? I was the one that said that's what we do all day long. But for me, I would say the benefits were, if we look at just data alone, for a Black-owned business, we receive less than a half of a percentage point of startup capital. We tend not to last after 3 years, and we've been here for 7. And just overall looking at the data, the odds don't seem that they're in my favor. But we turn them on our head through the strategy of collaboration. Literally, I think I had one of those calls with Lerner to check in point. They were like, can we speak to your sales director? You're talking to her. Can we speak to who's overseeing print and design on our first catalog? I'm like, I'm right here. Just call the question this way. But I say all this to say by default, I had to be to ensure that we had the sustainability and longevity to even make it this far. So when I literally looked at all the functionality of these imaginary positions that do not exist currently in our publishing house, I asked myself, who in my network can do these functions? How can I leverage it so it's mutually beneficial? Case in point, audiobooks. Dan brought me through Minnesota Disability Services to record the audiobooks in their lab. I didn't even know it existed. Right off 280, he was like, come on in. Our lab's your lab. I was like, are you serious? He said, yes. So I'm just giving you examples that it's not a one size fits all. And you'll have to think very carefully about strategy and skill set. And also for me, this is a long-term plan. I was just looking at the data and probably boring my table mates because I was like, here, let's look at this data together as soon as I was walking in. And if we're going to also, once again, another agenda point for me is increasing the diversity of the publishing industry. In order to do that, I also have to create these learning opportunities, these apprenticeship and other pieces to fill in some of those voids. So actually, I would say this kind of scrappiness, as Minnesotans would call it, has been to my advantage. I've been able to diversify the publishing industry. They just listed that the average African-American author is earning under $10,000 in the range of the average of about $8,000. We've changed that on its head. Our authors are earning at that level with their first book. So when I'm thinking about what is changing dramatically is ensuring that we have a range of options available and using the partnerships in our community through an assets-based approach.
Andrew, we'll go to you next.
Yeah, so it's interesting in the question that you talk about this is partnerships, and I think that that's the right way to look at it because these are partnerships. The fact is that the book business is an ecosystem, and it's an ecosystem of a lot of different players. And a book, as it travels from an author through a publisher to a reader, actually ends up passing through a lot of different hands. And all those different hands, those distributors, those booksellers, those librarians, they all do really important work for connecting books with their audiences. And so it is a tremendous amount of work to manage these partnerships, but it's also why we're here, really. Maintaining these partnerships and making sure that everybody's doing as well as we can be doing. Ingram, Baker & Taylor, Brodart, Follett, Mackin, these are all partners. And when we've got a book that's really doing well in any one particular channel, that's good for everybody. So it's a lot of work to maintain these partnerships, but it's valuable, and it's really where the rubber meets the road, I think, in the publishing industry.
Hannah?
Thanks. I'd say that one of the biggest benefits to our distribution model is that we aren't doing the statements and invoicing. Our Itasca Books does that for us, so we don't have to do the math. That's something we were talking about at our table before. We're not the ones crunching those numbers, which I love. but one of the challenges of having, our distributor be working directly with our authors is that we do have less control. And so we do have to, like you said, nurture that partnership, make sure that we have a working relationship with the team, that is at Itasca in order to best serve our authors. And so where we're able to have that environment where we can collaborate, and for the mutually beneficial goal of supporting these books getting into the world.
In all of your situations, are there any outlets, retail or library or direct to consumer, that have been easier or harder to reach? And if you could also share one sort of like, I'm still trying to solve this problem, kind of a channel or target. Andrew, we'll start with you.
So I mean, you mentioned direct, and people are always talking about maybe direct to consumer is the next thing for publishing, and I think it is meaningful, but it's a really tough nut to crack. I think that the reality is that most books that make it to readers go through the hands of a bookseller, whether that bookseller is just an online platform like Amazon or Bookshop, or an actual bookseller who is putting something in someone's hands. The exception, I think, would be authors doing direct sales, because that does happen a lot. But you know, we always talk about, like, could direct sales be more of a thing in the future? I think this is something that publishers just talk about, but I don't really see it happening or growing in any meaningful way. I think we'll have to see. Retail, I think, or like big box retail, I think can be a challenge depending on the size of publisher you are, because those tend to be like really high risk and high reward sales, because big box like Target, they'll buy a lot of books, and if they don't sell all those books, they're going to return a lot of books. So, you know, that's a thing where if you break into retail, it's really crossing your fingers at that point. And I definitely know folks, you know, I'm in the business, it hasn't really happened at 15, 17, that have gotten a big sale and then have suffered like 6 months to a year later when they've just gotten a ton of stuff back, with stickers that you can't get on, you know, get off, all the nightmares that you hear about. So I think retail has been a tough nut to crack, but everything else for us works pretty well.
Hannah?
I would also agree that big box resellers are really the most challenging to break into. But what we've done to kind of pivot from there is really encourage the authors that we work with to develop their own personal connections with bookstores. And so it's not just, you know, the distributor's reps or the publisher's reps, but it is actually the author themselves that are developing that one-on-one connection. And oftentimes that's what's going to make the difference with getting a little placard that describes the book, or getting your book moved from the shelf to maybe a table. You know, if you're going in there and making it symbiotic between you and the actual people working at those bookstores as the author, that's oftentimes what makes the difference. And so we usually encourage people to have more of a snowball effect to their distribution rollout. And so instead of getting a book, you know, in every store right on launch month, we actually kind of flip that on its head and we'll say, you know, choose your three favorite bookstores. Really nurture those connections, because then you have specific places that you can tell the author can tell their audience to go to. You're not saying wherever books are sold, which is great, but that, you know, mostly that'll lead to Amazon, right? And so, but if you can say, I have a really fantastic relationship with Red Balloon, ask for this person at the counter, she's the best, you know, that's going to make it so that the bookstore is really going to actively work to keep you in their store. They see that effort being put out, and that's going to make a difference. And that's something that publishers can do, but oftentimes the biggest impact is an author with an individual book who's saying, you know, sending their specific audience to that specific store. So that's, one of the things we found success with. And along those same lines, to the point of direct-to-consumer sales from the author, one thing that our authors do is they'll offer special rewards through their website. So they'll say, you can buy your book on, you know, buy my book wherever books are sold, but if you want a signed copy with a special, you know, book plate in the front of the book, then come to my website. And so that sort of incentivization has worked out really well for encouraging those direct sales where our authors can make more money.
And Dr. Tyner?
How can I add to all these great ideas? I'm like, let me take notes. I would say the greatest challenge was the library system. In Minnesota alone, there are 137 districts. I was like, what in the world? And they want you to go one by one. I was like, forget it. Pass. I mean, I was like, there's only 400 libraries. I'm not going all over the place. And I think I just naturally gravitated towards that because I love the library. I said, no, I cannot go to 400 plus libraries and talk to the collections team and say, can you put our book? I'm just not going to do that. So I think the way even I turned that on its head was every time I received an award from ALA or something, I said, oh, let's get the libraries engaged related to our book. So eventually there was a kind of a trickle-down effect locally and nationally. But I'm not sure if that's your best strategy. I have an author friend that spends his, I feel like his life, reaching out to all 300 of those libraries. I wish him luck. That's probably at least 100 books sold in the past 5 years. I told him I will not spend my time there. So libraries can be a challenge, but once again, I think Lerner had the competitive advantage already having the relationships. So I left that side to Lerner. I concede all the points with major retailers. I would say one competitive advantage that we've had to turn it on its head, clearly, I love public speaking and engaging with people. I do a lot of pitch contests in front of retailers to support our publishing house. Therefore, I'm talking to the CEO directly. And I think sometimes people forget it, but there's politics in everything. So I negotiate my own deal up here, not down here. And in addition to that, one of, I would say, the strengths of our publishing house is that I'm a globally recognized speaker. Therefore, I'm bundling books with my speaking engagements, and then when they ask for the next speaker, who am I going to choose? My authors. So when I go into a city, I'm bringing four or five authors with me for speaking engagements, and we're moving media, we're moving everyone with us. And I would say last but not least, in knowing our audience and what we wanted to accomplish, I use Oprah's Black-owned bookstore list. And guess what? My team, myself, and my interns, we got together and we sent a letter to every one of those Black-owned bookstores. And that was kind of our onboarding to this process. It was important to us because I'll just say it. I'm amongst friends, so I like to tell you the sauce, as my younger folks say, or the tea. It's like, sure. But the truth is what it is. There's still a dilemma, though. We have to be honest with ourselves for a moment. Even as you go to a conference, whether it's Winter Institute or Children's Institute, for booksellers, they do not pick up books written by Black authors. If you don't believe me, go into the galley room and don't start taking all the books. I take them. I take a few thousand every institute, and that's for our summer program. I'm saying all this because we have to think very strategically. I think there's some inconsistencies on what we say we believe, what we support, and if we want diversity, it's going to take some effort in both the authors that we're bringing on and the books that we're selling as well.
Can you all share a lesson or a warning of sorts that you would give to anyone thinking about distribution? What's something that you wish you had known? And the next question will focus on successes. So let's make this a cautionary tales story to a publisher who is maybe, you know, a step or two removed from where you are and they want to get to that point. What's a thing that you would wish you would have known? Hannah, we'll start with you.
Kind of going back to my earlier point about Amazon glitches, my big warning would be never trust that things are how you submitted them. Any big technology platform is going to have glitches. And so I would encourage everybody, especially if you're just getting your distribution started, to really be a little paranoid, to set up calendar reminders, to cross-check the listing, and be especially vigilant on release day. And I think that, anytime that there are glitches, communication is really just the best strategy. We have a very comprehensive FAQ around Amazon for our authors. And so if they have a question like, hey, why, is there now HTML in this listing? They're going to know that it's something that is not just something that's happened to their book. It's something that has happened many times. So we know how to fix it. We know exactly what to do, and we will handle it. So just kind of like staying ahead of that panicky feeling by really being transparent with the authors is what I would recommend. Not just waiting, not just crossing your fingers and hoping that they don't notice it, but just having that direct communication about the struggles, of distribution and how, we are intentionally working to circumvent them.
And Andrew?
I think The big one is don't put too many eggs in the Amazon basket. It's really tempting, I think, as you get a publishing program started to lean on Amazon really heavily, because they're kind of the easiest to get into, both from a self-publishing and even from like a traditional publishing model. You know, there's a very easy to access portal no matter what direction you're going. And other relationships might be harder to develop, distribution relationships, because, you know, it's more like person driven. You have to, like, you might want to actually get a person on the phone, where it's like hard to do that at Amazon, but they'll take your stuff no matter what. But the danger of putting too many eggs in the Amazon basket is that, you know, if there's a change in how they do things, that's like at that point that's a big percentage of your business on the line. And just recently they have been through major changes in how they stock their warehouses during the pandemic. They stocked up huge and ended up opening a bunch of distribution centers. And then there was a period where they pulled back and either started returning books or didn't order them to quite the extent that they had been prior. And to a publisher, I mean, to some extent, this is all publishers. By the last count, I heard Amazon accounts for something like 70% of all book sales in the industry, which is terrifying. But, you know, I think, so everybody suffers when a player that accounts for 70% of all sales changes something in how they do things, and eventually things even out and go back to normal. But, you know, if you can be looking to other distribution channels as you develop that Amazon piece, I think that's ideal. You know, just to drive up as much as you can the percentage of sales that come through a variety of channels, not just one very dominant online bookseller. Hope they're not like listening.
Of course they are. And Dr. Tyner, what's your cautionary tale?
I would say the journey of always learning. So I'm just thinking about all the Amazon stories, the formatting of the book profile. One day I thought I had everything all set up, and they were like, no, we didn't include that in the book description. But I was like, put it in there. Like, how did that happen? So I would say that piece of learning and check again and check again and check again. And then as you're working with your distributor, once again, it's a learning journey. There are things that you would say, oh, I would do it this way, but internally they may have a different process. So I would say it's the most humble journey that is continuous of learning on top of learning. That's how I'll explain it.
And that goes back to the partnership aspect as well. All right, now let's talk about a success. What's a successful experience that you've had through one of your distribution pathways that, you know, you wouldn't have been able to pull off if you had been doing it in a different way? Andrew, I think we'll start with you this time.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this. There've been, it's always the surprises that I think about, the big sale that you didn't expect to get. And for us, that's primarily been, I think, in our children's program. You know, in the bio, you mentioned three imprints. Our children's imprint is Beaming Books. And there will be surprises there, and often it comes from the educational market, which is not a market we pursue as like a first order of business. Obviously, you know, you're from Learner, that is like a big part of your business. It's a smaller part of ours, but we have seen where, you know, a book that's been doing pretty well, kind of slowed down in the backlist, suddenly we'll get a few thousand copies sold through Follett or Mackin in a particular school district, and that's just like, it's a celebratory moment for the whole publishing, for the whole team, because it's like one of those happy surprises. And it's one of those happy surprises that only happen because you invite the contact that you have to your sales conference, because you cultivate that relationship over time, because they become passionate about your books and tell them to educators or superintendents or whoever's making these book purchases. So I'd say, you know, just kind of like keeping the faith with these partnerships, and then having those happy accidents come along that support what you've been doing all along.
And Dr. Tyner?
I would say one of the pleasant surprises as of late have been related to international rights for the books. I didn't have that in mind. I mean, I'm selling out the trunk, running here and there. I was like, let's just conquer Minnesota. And I would say Lerner as a distributor gave us access to become what we dreamed of being a national and global entity, and also having the expertise to be able to negotiate those contracts. Because I would have just said yes, yes, and yes. I give everything away. Yeah, you need a book here. But realizing that we have to have revenue to give the books out, of course, based upon our social enterprise model. So that piece has been a dramatic change for us. And it even caused me, I'm going to pivot. So here's a little tip for you all as well. I'm going to apply from some of the funding from DEED related to export training to think very strategically. And you can tell by now, knowing me these few minutes, we're going to dominate in Africa. Because still yet, they're selling books that are colonial books to our children, and we're coming home and we're taking over the whole market. So therefore, I'm going to get the resources from DEED to start going to some of these international conferences to pitch our books.
And Hannah?
I can't wait to show her the recording of this because I always talk about her. But my success story is I want to talk about Crown Shepherd. She is my colleague at Wise Inc. And actually, we first met when I was her project manager at Beavers Pond Press for her first book, Black Boy, Black Boy. And the reason I want to highlight her as a success story is I think that she's a just fantastic example of what having agency over your book distribution can really do for you. So she did go full trade distribution. Her book, you know, was available in all the major distribution networks. But she also, because she, you know, keeps 100% of the royalties for her books, she got really into tabling events. And so she started making that a really big part of her book selling business. She was doing tabling events at art fairs, farmers markets. She started getting a regular booth at farmers markets. And, you know, it was just really engaging with the community. And what she says about her tabling event experience is that it's not just about the book sales, although those really were very, very, you know, strong. But she was also meeting a lot of teachers. And so when she was out at those tabling events, she was in community. She was, you know, able to make these personal relationships with people. And that led to not only sales during that day, but to a whole box of books at a school event. And she was so successful with her tabling events that she actually started a mobile bookstore called Liberate Your Bookshelf. And she now sells books on behalf of other authors. And so I think that she's one of my favorite success stories in a lot of ways. But just having that ability to follow where you're led and play into your strengths and, you know, be able to use all the different distribution pathways, whether from direct to, you know, trade distribution, I think that's just really fantastic.
That's such a great example, too, of someone who opens a channel for themselves and then is suddenly able to open a channel for others as well. That's a really unique and unexpected turn. So this is the last question on my list, so I want you all to start thinking of your questions because we'll have a few minutes for Q&A. We touched on this a little bit, but if you can talk about digital distribution, ebooks, audiobooks, and sort of how that fits into your overall distribution plan. And Dr. Tyner, we'll start with you.
Ebooks have been essential to our success. Now, for me, that's an evolution. I still like to read the book, annotate it, and say, on page 38, that's that research point you need to look for. Mm-hmm. But why did I bring that quick example? Remember, you're not your audience that you're seeking to serve, depending on the situation, right? So if I went by what I thought, I never would have thought about ebooks or audiobooks because I don't use either one. Don't tell. I always say, yes, they're amazing when Libro asks and when other distributors ask, but I don't. I prefer a physical book. So I would say it opened up the doors for us to have many opportunities. One, it solved a bit of that dilemma with the library, because through BBL Labs, we can get the audiobooks into the libraries, get our royalties from that payment as well. So I would say it's helped us to just think strategically and reach more people in creative ways. All right, here's the unconventional piece. I told you what everybody else is doing. But I would say what made us unique, we have a YouTube channel. We create our own visual experience, okay? So I'm behind the scenes, I'm testing out some things with, and I'm gonna say it since it hasn't been said in the room yet, AI. to do more interactive book readings and make them accessible. Because one of the things that I'm seeing, especially since we specialize in children's books, the greatest challenge is that not every young person, ideally in the situation you do, but not every young person has someone that's reading to them and engaging with them. Can I replicate that experience through technology?
Hannah?
So our digital distribution is not very exciting currently, so I'm really excited to hear from the other panelists about what's working for you. We mostly are using Amazon KDP for ebook distribution and Audible for audiobook distribution. But we don't publish many audiobooks a year, which is a shame because I'm primarily an audiobook listener. But because our authors are paying for the cost of audiobook production, it can be pretty pricey. And so it's not a good financial model for most of them. But for the ones that we do, we are looking into audiobook distribution with Findaway Voices. And so if anybody has had experience with that, I'd be really interested to hear about it. But yeah, nothing too exciting or out of the ordinary with our ebook or with our digital distribution. I think the one thing I'd say that we found through Amazon KDP is there's a way for an organization to buy books on ebooks on behalf of their employees or of conference attendees, and so that sort of like ability to facilitate bulk orders is something that our authors have been able to do through Amazon for ebooks.
Andrew?
So ebook distribution is pretty solid for us, I think, at this point. We produce ebooks as a part of our production process for every title that we publish in print, and then we give it to a partner called Fusion, and they distribute it to all the channels. So it's in Amazon, but also, you know, Barnes & Noble Nook and Kobo, and at least available on platforms like OverDrive. So that's what we do for ebooks. And then audio, we did experiment early on with self-producing audio for a small selection of titles, and that was mainly about, you know, kind of experimenting with a small budget of how it would look to actually produce these ourselves, hiring the producer, hiring the narrator, and then distributing it ourselves through Audible. And that did well enough, but ultimately we got in with an audiobook licensing partner. They're actually a publisher called Recorded Books, and they have a number of sub-imprints, and they produce some, you know, thousands of titles every year in audio. They're exclusively an audiobook publisher. And what they do is they work with mid-size publishers, essentially looking at every list that is produced and for which we have audio rights, and offering to license that from us, produce an audiobook, publish it under their own imprint, and then pass through royalties to us, which eventually get passed through to the author. And there are a number of players like this out there right now, because audio is a growing field, and there's a number of places who are just looking to print publishers' lists to build their own audio-only list. So we work with Recorded Books, but anything that they pass on, we can offer to other players like Dreamscape Audio, Blackstone Audio. A new one on the scene is called Podium Audio. I think Podium is more fiction than nonfiction. We publish nonfiction, so we have to focus on those. But all this to say, if audio is a challenge for you and you have you're publishing books that would be appropriate in audio, getting some sort of a relationship with one of these audio houses is a way that you can get your stuff into audio for your authors, and have a revenue stream that gets passed through to you back to your author. That's how we do it.
Love that tip.
Yeah. I can give you some names maybe afterwards, yeah.
Excellent. All right, we've got 5 minutes, so I probably have time for one or two questions, and I'll come around with the lav mic here.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. I have an audio-related question. I'm an author who has a book that I produced in audio with professional voiceover and everything. I am wondering how, so you talked a little bit about these different distributors, and but what about like metadata? Like, where's the connection with getting it to the reader? Like, you know what I mean?
Versus audio metadata?
Yeah, versus like, I know about Amazon and the metadata and stuff like that, but like, how do you...
In our model?
Sure. Any model.
Well, I mean, I think if you're self-distributing it, if you're producing it and distributing it yourself, there's probably just a completely separate metadata feed that you can do for that product, but then like tie it to the print if it is audio for print. What our partners do is they just copy our metadata, basically. You know, so when we do a print and ebook, we obviously take care of the metadata for that. And then the audiobook partner to which we've licensed the audio right, and then they produce it themselves. They just keep all the same metadata with a few of their own feeds, right? Like there's one of the key metadata feeds for audiobook is length, how many hours. Like that doesn't make any sense for a print book. So, you know, they take care of their own metadata. But if you're doing it yourself, I don't have any experience with it actually. It's on Audible. I think that they probably just have a portal that you can put a lot of the same things in. Give Jenna a mic.
Yeah, it should be connected.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. Do you use Edelweiss, and how does that tie into your distribution outreach?
Yes.
Can you repeat? Do you use Edelweiss? Oh. Are you signed up with that? I assume Andrew and iSchoolLearner uses Edelweiss. I don't know, but
I think that Itasca does as well.
Yeah. We don't yet.
Yeah. So, all right. Yeah, so for the recording, I'm going to repeat the question. Do you use Edelweiss? And if so, how does that connect to your distribution process?
So Edelweiss is one of the platforms that we send metadata to. It ends up being a critical piece for us to get the word out about books. It's a way to get digital advance copies into the hands of folks like librarians, reviewers, etc. We also use it for sell sheets. I mean, it's basically like a sell sheet platform, right? It's a way to get information out about a book in advance of publication and have it all be in one place. And it's a very, like, it's where industry folks go to find out about what's new and exciting. So it's critical for us, and it's like the centerpiece of our, like, sales conference, which I talked about earlier. So as we're equipping our sales rep groups, pointing to Edelweiss is a big piece.
And independent sales rep groups can accept orders through Edelweiss from bookstores, but that's sort of a different level of account than what publishers have access to with Edelweiss. Other questions? Looks like we have time for maybe one more.
Hi. So I used to work in-house, but I'm currently getting ready to self-publish a very niche nonfiction book. And I'm planning for now just to be mailing out orders on my own. I guess this question is maybe for Hannah mainly. What do you think is the threshold, both in terms of budget and in, you know, how many books a person can physically mail by themselves? At what point, like what sales level, sales volume, it would make sense for a self-publishing author to go for a professional distributor?
First of all, congratulations on your upcoming launch. The first thing I'll just want to seed plant about is if you're planning on fulfilling orders yourself, I would encourage you to think about a Kickstarter campaign. So Kickstarter, a lot of people think of it as a way to just raise money for a book and like asking for money, but it basically is a vehicle for pre-orders now. And so that first you know, inner circle of your network, which are your friends, your family, the people who are going to buy the book because they know you, I kind of think of them as your guaranteed sales. And so doing direct sales with something like Kickstarter, where maybe you can like add on a little something extra. And so if the book costs $20, they get a book and, you know, like a postcard or a signed copy or an invitation to an exclusive virtual event for $30, you know, and so you're able to like really put some money into your marketing from those guaranteed sales is the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that depending on how big your network is, I think I recently read a study that was saying most people have a network that they know of up to 500 people. Obviously not all 500 people are going to buy the book, you know, or know you well enough to like be that guaranteed sale, but you're going to know once you hit that threshold, and it's going to be work to fulfill those orders in the beginning of it. But at a certain point, everybody in your network is going to have already known of the book, told somebody about the book, and the sales will kind of slow to a smaller, more manageable amount. And so I'd say just kind of like get ready for the first couple months, you know, especially that first month is going to be a really big push of fulfilling orders. But then after that, you'll kind of know once the sales slow down enough. If you're doing direct distribution only, it'll be more of a like plateau compared to the snowball effect if you're really pushing your book out there on a larger platform. And I'd recommend stamps.com or something like that, where they can pick up from your home. You don't even have to go to the post office. So, and ship media mail, also cheaper.
Can I add to that one just a little bit? You got the green on, so Girl Scouts honor, right? So the first book that we did, Justice Makes a Difference, similar to everything that you said. I said niche market, diverse book. We got everything here. But I used the Girl Scouts honor to get that book sold to the tune of $30,000 in sales in about 6 months. I was like, what was on that cookie order form? And I sent out a team, and because Kickstarter, all those things are wonderful, but crowdfunding has its own things, fees and all that, and you know I want my money direct. I'm pro-green. So I was like, give me my money. So I was like, I'm not sharing fees, and I'm doing all this work. And then when you're talking about fulfillment, I know this might sound unconventional, but I have pizza parties in my writing studio, and I bring people together, and you'd be shocked which friends will come and help. I think this takes us full circle. You can only do this work through the power of partnerships. It's different for me. I'm a lawyer. I'm not looking for partnerships. I'm looking to take you down. So this is a different industry. I learned how to work with people. But I'm just going to give you this piece. Whether it's Kickstarter, you do it independently like a Girl Scout on some order forms, and I made some. I don't even know what they look like, but I was like, hey, take this with you wherever you go. Told 10 friends, and we did it. Do not forget, if you don't take anything from what we said, all of the success is in the power of partnerships.
Well, I'm going to just stop it right there because we can't get any better than that. Also, we're at time. So thank you very much to all three of our panelists. And thank you very much for coming. This is the last meeting of the season, so we will see you back here in the fall. Have a great summer. Thank you.